This is Bob Brundage, and today is Sunday, March 6th, 2011, and I'm having the pleasure of talking with Gardner Patton back in Bridgewater, New Jersey.
Yep. And
very happy to have a chance to talk to Gardner because he has been so helpful with this oral history project we've been having for the Square Dance Foundation in New England. And we'll talk about that as time goes along. But so, Gardner, why don't you tell us a little bit about your early background, and we'll take it from there.
Okay. Thanks. It's very nice to be on the other end of the interview with you, Bob. It's quite interesting. I was born in Boston, believe it or not. And then my family moved to Portland, Oregon, when I was about 7. And so I grew up in Portland, Oregon. And then later on, for college, I came back to the East Coast, to Providence, Rhode Island again. But there's a few things that in my early days that are fairly interesting that have to do with later on my
development.
The development in dancing, but also as part of your project, your oral history project.
Uh-huh.
And it turns out that before I was born, my mother was a secretary at Harvard University in the physics department. And this was before the atom bomb was built. And so she had ideas about what her new son that she was going to have should be. And she wanted me to be a physicist,
uh-huh.
of course, because she worked for all these people in the physics department. She had an office over the cyclotron, which was new in those days, and atomic power was just coming in, and they really hadn't had an atomic bomb yet. And so she got all excited about that. And then later on, she felt that secretarial skills that she had were very important. So as I grew up in Portland, instead of going out and playing baseball with the kids after school, she had me sitting, taking typing lessons from her.
Hey.
And so I got to be a pretty fast typer, and that's why when your project came along and you said you needed somebody to transcribe your tapes, I felt I could probably do that because I had that typing experience when I was young. So the another thing happened in Portland that had to do with a dancing career. My father was a principal of the school that I went to, and right in our neighborhood. And he had very strong ideas about learning to dance. And a lot of the kids in the neighborhood were going off to dancing schools, and where the girls would wear the white gloves and the guys would wear suits, and you'd learn all about going over and asking the girl to dance politely and
really
seeing her back to her seat and all that kind of thing. But my father said, no, you shouldn't learn to dance that way. You should learn to dance in the schools.
Uh-huh.
And so he had the 7th and 8th graders on rainy days would be able to come in and dance in the gym, supervised by the teachers, of course.
Yes.
And they learned a lot of the dancing, and they did some square dancing and some long ways dancing there. But I never did that because I was on the stage crew, which meant I got to run the noon movies.
Uh-huh.
And so during grade school, I really didn't get the dancing instruction that other people got either. I got it a little bit in the gym class, but not the way others got it.
That's interesting.
So that's one of the interesting things that happened in my youth about dancing.
Yes. Well, when was it that you moved to Bridgewater?
Oh, wasn't till after college.
Oh, I see.
There's a number of things that happened as I grew up that had to do with dancing. That my first real experience with the dancing was in 1956. I was an exchange student to Finland on the American Field Service. And in those days, there weren't airplanes, so you didn't travel by airplane to get there. We started from Portland, and we traveled by train all across the country to New York City. And then we got on a boat in New York City, and we all the students took over this whole boat, and we went off to, I guess we landed in Germany. And, of course, there wasn't much to do on the boat, so they had folk dancing for the countries that we were going to be traveling to.
Good art.
And so we got a lot of folk dancing experience, and this is
yes.
where I think I really got started in the folk dancing.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I should mention also that my father was a long ways dancing caller, so he would call contras. And, but he didn't do it that much. He was did it a lot, I think, when they lived in New England. But when he went out to Portland, he would do it once in a while, but not very often.
See?
And I never really got a chance to dance to him or see him prompt the long ways dances.
I see. That's interesting. So, well, do you call contra dances now at all?
No, not really. I sort of hooked on square dancing and folk dancing.
Right.
When I went to college, I went to Brown University.
Oh, yes. And,
so I was in Rhode Island, and the first summer after being a freshman, I worked up in Alaska for that first summer, and I was on Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage.
Uh-huh.
And that was the same time when they did the vote to make Alaska a state. So I was there in the summer when that vote was taken in 58 and saw Alaska become a state. But while I was there, in the evenings I didn't have anything to do. So because of the folk dancing experience, I went to the Y in Anchorage, and they had folk dancing, but they also mixed in the square dancing.
Yes.
And so I got square dancing there, and then I found out there were other groups on the Air Force base there. So I was going square dancing almost every night of the week.
Yes.
In Anchorage.
That's interesting.
And
remember
then
who the caller was?
Hmm?
You remember who the caller was?
Nope, I don't. I think it was just, you know, a local person at the, well, at the Y, it was just, you know, the recreation director at the Y.
Yes.
But I don't remember who the callers were on the Air Force base.
Yes. Well, of course, there were a lot of service people that got into square dancing, especially overseas.
Oh, yes.
A lot of them came back after WW2 and started in the activity here. Predominantly people like Cal Golden and people like that.
Yeah, well, it was interesting because I told John Kaltenfaller, you know, where I started dancing on the Air Force base, and he said, oh, you can belong to the to the group of overseas, you know, they have that group for the people who learned overseas. And Alaska was considered overseas in those days, I think.
There wasn't much of a sea between here and there, though.
No.
So, well, that's interesting.
But I came back from there, and that's when I started calling.
Yes.
I started at the YMCA in Providence.
Yes.
And Bob Kent was the caller. I hadn't remembered his name, but...
Yes, I knew.
You had got together with Lori Marin, and she figured out that it was Bob.
Yes. As a matter of fact, while I was waiting to talk to you this morning, I emailed Lori and asked her if she remembered you. Did you also know Dick Ledger there?
I danced to Dick, but I didn't know him.
I see.
In those days, I really didn't know very much about square dancing.
I see.
And so there's a lot of things that happened that I look back now and I say, wow, I got to dance to Dick Ledger
right.
in his own hall. And, of course, we've talked about Square Acres and going up to Square Acres where you could do rounds or squares at different levels.
Yes. Oh, you went to Square Acres a few times?
Oh, yes.
Well, we're still waiting to talk to Don Sargent to who was the round dance cure there. I was waiting to interview him. But anyway, well.
So I started calling and taught a class at the Y in Providence in 58.
Yes, was that the B squares?
I'm sorry?
Was that the B squares?
No. The B sharps.
The B sharps.
Squares is down in New Jersey.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But this was the group Bob wasn't interested in at that point in teaching new people at the Y, and I was. So I didn't have a car, and I used to walk 1.5 miles down to the Y from my dorm room and then teach the class and walk back.
Yes.
And so that was my first experience. And I also did folk dancing while I was in college.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I met my wife, Diana.
I see.
There was a woman, Judy Schreier, who I noticed on the web, is she still dancing?
Is that right?
And she was leading the folk dance group. Her husband was in the psychology lab, and she would lead folk dancing, and she would let us teach folk dances. So I knew some folk dances, and so I was also teaching some of the folk dances at the folk dance group.
Yeah. Did you... You probably didn't get that involved in folk dancing that you went to any of the folk dance camps like Michael Herman or anything like that?
I didn't go to the camps. I went to Michael Herman's in New York a few times after.
Did you really?
In New Jersey.
In Greenwich Village, yes.
Yeah. That was quite exciting.
I'm sure. I did a square dance. They wanted, I did a series of modern Western square dance classes at his hall.
Oh, wow.
That was many years ago.
Yeah.
I was also familiar with May Gadd, who was the Northeast director of the folk dancing people in the United States. It was the Country Dance Society. But anyway, okay, well, shall we talk about the... Callers Council of New Jersey?
Well, what I was going to do before we get to that was talk about a little bit about dancing in New Jersey. When I came here, I graduated from college in 61 and came right to New Jersey. Well, actually, I went to North Carolina for 6 months for training first, and did some dancing down there where I found out that they dance differently in the South than they did
right
up here. So that was quite enlightening.
Right.
And then when I got to New Jersey, I wanted to start calling again, and the local caller was Lloyd Sewers. And he sold me his caliphone, his old caliphone turntable and speakers.
I went through two or three of them.
Right, I bet. I still have mine. I'm looking at it on the shelf right now.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's got its tubes, and I even have spare tubes for it. So every once in a while, I fire it up.
Good.
But he sold me that and pointed out some places to call, and then Dick Pazwoski, I think you know him.
Sure.
And he was calling in New Jersey, and when he would have some too many dances to call, he would call me up, and I'd do some of his dances for him.
Good.
And the interesting thing is that he and I, at that time, just talked on the phone, and we didn't meet until probably 30-some years later at the Callers Association.
I'll be darned.
So I just knew him by the phone.
Yeah. Well... So that's when you started the B-sharps, or was that a...
Nope. Well, first thing I had to do was I got married. And I mentioned earlier that I met Diana at the folk dance group at Brown.
Right.
And she was from New York, and actually above New York, in East Chester, New York. You might know that area.
Yes, right.
But anyway, we got married in 63, and so one thing that I needed to do was teach her to square dance. So we went out dancing a lot. We did some folk dancing and some square dancing, And she never had formal lessons at that point. So we got very frustrated at later in the 60s because of people inventing new calls all the time and so forth. And so we actually got out of square dancing for a while and did folk dancing. And I headed up a folk dance group in Morristown, New Jersey for several years. And finally that group folded, and I inherited a box of folk dance records from them. But we sort of got out of dancing. I was still calling one-nighters, but we didn't go dancing a lot. And then we got back into dancing again, and my wife formally took lessons with me. And Al Adirante was the caller when we took lessons, and we made a lot of friends there. It was Hanover Squares.
Okay.
And they danced in Whippany, New Jersey, Hanover, New Jersey. And so we really got into it at that point, and then became presidents of Hanover Squares. And there's a lot of things that are interesting during that time, because we had as callers Jerry Schatzer. I don't know whether you knew Jerry.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
But he went out to California eventually, but he was very young when he was calling for us.
Yeah.
He actually, after Al Adirante quit, I guess we took lessons in 72, and Al Adirante gave up fairly close after that, and Hal Holmes and Jerry Schatzer took over the classes in 73, and we were presidents in 74. And another of the callers that's interesting was Will Larson. He's from Connecticut.
Yes. Yeah.
And when he came down, he had to be driven down by his parents because he wasn't old enough to drive yet.
Yes, right.
And so we had Will as a caller, and that was quite interesting. He was a very good caller.
Yeah, he must have introduced you to Challenge then.
No, I didn't. We didn't get that far at that point.
Yes.
But another thing about Jerry, we had the gas crisis. And so Jerry was coming down from Connecticut. And we had a deal where he would have enough gas to get down to New Jersey, but we had to provide him enough gas to get home again.
Yes, right.
Or else he wouldn't come down. And so that was in 73, 74, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Somewhere around there. So we're almost getting to B-sharps.
Okay.
But right around that time, my job changed. And so I moved to Bridgewater, and Dick Jones had moved out into this area in 1970.
Oh, I've gotten that. That's right.
And he and Artie had started groups out here. And he was a caller for six clubs as well as being a national caller at that point.
Yes.
But they had a very interesting arrangement. He had about three or four or five maybe other callers calling with him. And that was the time when the calls were exploding. And so there was A calls and AA calls and AAA calls. And so, you know, A calls were 1 through 79 that we know now, and AA were 80 through 100, and AAA were 100 through 125.
Ish.
But what they would do is sort of run a multi-cycle kind of thing. They'd get a group, and one of the callers would take them through the bottom level, and then they'd start another group, and other people could jump in at the higher levels.
Yes.
And they would trade calling around between the different callers. And so that, you know, if one had to go, like if Dick was away on a trip across the country, one of the other callers would jump in for him.
Yes.
Or if they needed a new group, one of those callers would start up, and they would all sort of be part of the same umbrella club in some cases. So B-sharps had many different classes going at the different levels as well as the B-sharps dances.
That'll be darned, yeah.
And it was caller run at that point. And so Dick was sort of arranging all of that. And so we started dancing with Dick. And we did that for a while. In 77, we went to the Atlantic City Convention, the 26th
right.
annual convention. And then we got back out of square dancing again for a while and did some folk dancing in Bridgewater. Then Dick Jones died in 82, and the B-Sharps was taken over by Ralph Stapanel, who was from England. And we'll have to get all the spellings of these names later. I guess I should stop and spell some of them. But so the B-Sharps moved around to different places, and then we jumped back into B-Sharps. And I was still doing one-night dances, but I wasn't really calling an awful lot.
I see.
And the interesting thing about Dick Jones was that after he had died, his records got passed on to one of his friends. And later on, when I had a chance, I bought Dick Jones's records and microphones.
I'll be darned.
And so forth. And so I have those now. And, of course, what you were alluding to was that I am now the class caller for the B-Sharps.
Yes, right.
And so I've basically taken over a Dick Jones legacy, in a sense. And so, for example, I try to call a lot of the dances that he called and keep the history going within
yes.
the club so that people remember Dick and what he started.
Okay, well, so along this time, I meant to have asked you earlier, do you call the advanced level at all?
No. In a sense, I know a number of the advanced calls because a lot of them
yes.
are calls that we learned ages ago, and they just drop them from the...
Yes, right.
Mainstream program and the plus program, and they become advanced.
So,
but my feeling is that at the higher levels, dancing is a lot of stop and go.
Sure, it is.
Yeah. The caller calls something, the people go, and then they stop.
Yep.
And then when they stop, the caller calls something else, and there's not that flow in the dancing.
Of course,
I find it frustrating.
When a caller gives a call, and people move around, and he says, "Hey, George, you belong over here."
Exactly.
And he gives the next call.
Yep. And there's very few callers who will do singing calls at the higher levels.
Oh, yes. I didn't know any of them did.
Yeah, well, Betsy Gatta does.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And of course, she's one of the people that around here.
Yes.
We'll be talking more about her, I think, later.
Right. Do you cue rounds at all?
I do cue rounds.
Well, good for you.
Starting with the folk dancing, I got so that I could essentially cue the folk dances or prompt the folk dances or whatever. And so cueing rounds is not that different than cueing folk
yes.
dances.
Yes. It's interesting, by the way, do you teach rounds at all in your beginner classes, square dance classes?
No.
I always
no.
did.
Yes, we always used to have the rounds, and the callers would teach the rounds.
Yeah.
And I did that back in the 60s, but I haven't done it these days. And it's interesting. In my class now, I have angels that are just taking rounds.
Yes.
Roy Gatta is teaching a round dance class, and there's 12 couples from the B-sharps that are taking this round dance class. So I said, okay, what I'll do is in my class I'll cue rounds for the people who are learning the rounds so that they'll get some extra practice.
Sure.
And so I was doing that for several weeks, and the president of the club came up and said, can we ask you not to cue rounds between the tips for the class? And they said, we really ought to have the angels talking with the new dancers.
I see.
And getting that bond as opposed to the angels going out and doing something else between the tips. And they had a point.
Yeah.
So I mix rounds in once in a while. And
yeah.
Simple ones or more complicated ones.
Did you ever think that you might have a half hour of rounds before the square dance class or something like that?
Yes, actually, what I usually do is I say, if anybody wants to come, I'm there a half hour early, and we can do whatever you want to request. If it's teaching
yes.
the squares that we did last week, you know, the new calls that they learned, I'll do that. And what I've got is I've got some of the angels coming, and so we do some of the rounds before the class starts. If it's, you know, if the students aren't there wanting something, then we'll do rounds.
So, well, outside of your Callers Council of New Jersey, do you belong to other organizations? I know you belong to Caller Lab.
Yeah, I'm a member of Caller Lab.
Yeah, and you do attend some of the conventions?
I've attended two of the conventions.
Okay.
I didn't join Caller Lab until I started calling the classes on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
When I was calling one-night stands, I hadn't joined Caller Lab.
Yes. How about festivals? You participate in festivals?
Not really. I think the biggest thing that I ever called at was the Morris County Fair. And we had a group of dancers demonstrating at that fair, but nothing bigger than that, really.
Yes. Well... Well, that's interesting.
That's certainly an interesting experience when you get up and you're calling and then the music echoes off the other end of the field. And
yes.
You hear yourself way behind the music and so forth. It throws you off a little bit if you aren't expecting it.
I've been reminiscing about the biggest square dance I ever called for. That was in Omaha, Nebraska.
Uh-huh.
At a place called Exarban Coliseum.
Hmm.
300 squares.
Wow.
What a sight.
Wow.
That was one of the biggest thrills of my life.
Yeah, I can't imagine anything that big.
Yes.
You know, it's just, you know, how do you keep everybody together on something like that? You really
Well,
can't.
This was back in 58, and dancing was not so complicated as it is today.
Yeah, that's true.
So
that's the trouble that I've found, because I started off as a caller who memorized a dance that went with a record.
Sure.
And then I got into patter and used modules as they were came out in sets and order and
yes.
so forth. And nowadays everything is sight calling. You know, most of the callers are doing sight calling.
Yes.
With some backup modules, and so I've had to work on my sight calling.
Yes. Well, something I never learned, but and as a matter of fact, I'm glad I'm not a caller today. But how about the your New Jersey callers?
Well, I'm a member of that, and I've been the corresponding secretary and the first vice president, and right now I'm nominated to be president.
Yes.
And I think I'll probably be president because there's nobody running against me. We'll find out in a week or so.
Uh-huh.
But the one of the things that we've done as a callers association, I think, is quite interesting, is that we've said if we have more callers, we're going to have more dancers.
Yes.
Because callers go out and teach and go do one-night stands and so forth, and
right.
people become interested in dancing. And so the Callers Association membership was going down as people died and retired from calling. And so we found a group of dancers who wanted to be callers. And so we said, well, we'll run a class for callers.
Yes.
And the interesting way that we did it was we had a session on Sunday afternoons, a series of Sunday afternoons in the fall. We started that way. And the idea was that the caller would learn some techniques, be able to go home during the week and study the techniques. Maybe they would have a chance to try out the techniques on a group of people and then come back the next week with the thought that they would have questions.
Yes.
Because a lot of times when you go to a caller school, they cram everything into 3 days, and you're just, you get a little chance to practice,
yes,
but you don't really have time to think.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And some people don't even have a chance to try the things they want to try.
Yes.
And so the idea was by spreading the series of classes out, it would give the callers, new callers, a chance to think about what they were learning. And yet it was still a series of classes where they built on each other, so you got the experience of a caller school, but it was just spaced out. It's sort of the way that Toast classes where they built on each other, so you got the experience of a caller school, but it was just spaced out. It's sort of the way that Toastmasters teaches you to speak in speaking. I was a member of Toastmasters from 61 to 2003, so I'm a big fan of the Toastmasters Club as a way to learn to get up in front of groups and talk and,
right,
and learn how to do things like it helped with the calling.
Yes.
But anyway, we did that, and so we had a good group of callers come out of that, and they went off, and some of them helped out in classes and got some experience, and then we had another series of, I think it was 4 classes, the following year. And those people, then we started workshops. We said the callers may not be able to get a lot of experience calling in front of regular dancers, so what we'll do is we'll have workshops on a monthly basis where we just get the callers, members of the Callers Association and their significant others together, and we'd get about 2 squares together and let the new callers practice calling. And they could do anything they wanted, but the only thing that they had to do was before they started to call a square, they had to say what their purpose was in doing the square. And it could be sight resolution, or it could be using a specific call, or it could be trying out a new kind of music. And so as long as they said what they were doing, we gave them 10 minutes, and we had a little leg timer there that if when it got to the end of the 10 minutes and the bell went off, you had to stop even if you were in the middle of a dance.
Uh-huh.
And that gave them a chance to check their timing. And we would run 15-minute tips. They would call for 10 minutes, and then we had evaluation forms.
I see.
And people would fill out evaluation forms with constructive feedback, and, you know, maybe if they saw something the caller could do better, they would suggest that and maybe how to do it, or if they thought the caller was doing something really well, they would mention that. And so the back.
Yes. So it wasn't really a panel of judges, in other words. It was just...
No, absolutely not.
Yes.
Because right. The callers were at different levels.
Yes.
And they would, you know, some of them were still having trouble using the record player and holding the microphone right and so on and so forth.
Yes.
I should mention also that as a Callers Association, we were very lucky because we had 3 Caller Lab accredited coaches.
Yes.
Who were part of the association, and that's Mike Jacobs and Betsy Gatta and John Kaltenthaler.
Right.
And so they turned up being the instructors for the course. John Kaltenthaler was at that point starting to retire from calling. And so he took this on, and he coordinated everything. And so we got some really good callers giving us help during the lessons.
Yes.
For the callers. And then those callers, John and Betsy and Mike, also came to the workshops and would give some of the feedback at the workshops.
Well, that's great.
And it worked out really well. And these callers now have gone out. They're calling one-night stands. Some of them have started calling as regular callers around the area. Some have taken over groups. We had Mike Jacobs died in the meantime, and so he left a number of groups, and he was calling all the way from a seniors group that could barely dance, in the sense that their faculties were not that good, and they couldn't move fast, and some of them couldn't hear. And so we had one caller take over that group, and another caller took over his advanced group that he was running.
Yes.
Out of this caller school. I mean, the callers who came to the school weren't all just going to call mainstream or plus. There, we had a couple, well, three callers wanted to call advanced and
yes.
challenge. And so they were advanced and challenge dancers, and they learned to call advanced and challenge.
Well, that's interesting. How many members do you have there now?
Gosh, the...
It's a pretty long system.
About 33.
I was going to say, must be 25 or 30 anyway.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is that they've all been so successful.
Yes.
And I forgot to mention one other thing that's really important. The clubs and the Northern New Jersey Square Dance Association all saw these new callers coming up and wanted to support them. And so one of the clubs, Lakeland Squares, which is was at the time a mainstream club, they wanted to go mainstream and plus.
Yes.
And so they were having plus lessons, and then they switched to the mainstream plus alternating format.
Yes.
But their mainstream dancer said, we can't dance mainstream like we used to. Why should we even come if we have to sit out half the dances? And so what they instituted was mainstream between tips, because they didn't have rounds between the tips.
Uh-huh.
And so what they would do is they would have a mainstream tip, then they would have an in-between mainstream tip with one of the new callers, then they would have a plus tip with a caller of the evening, and then they would have another between tip mainstream with one of the new callers.
I see.
And so the new callers got a chance to try out their mainstream calling skills.
Sure.
The mainstream dancers got a full night of mainstream.
Right.
The regular caller got the same money that they would have gotten and the same rest between tips that they would have gotten.
Yes.
And it was a win-win-win situation all the way around.
That sounds like a great idea.
And I think it's, you know, a model that could be used in other parts of the country in supporting the new callers. Because the new caller has the support of the regular caller who's there.
Yes.
And gets feedback from them. They don't get any money, but they get experience calling to real dancers.
Sure.
And I think it's just a super way to get new callers involved.
Have you brought this up to Caller Lab by any chance? They're always looking for new ideas.
Yeah, I haven't. I should probably write something for their winning ways.
Yes, you should.
And we've used that now for about almost 2 years, I guess. And it's interesting. One of the new callers now has his son has started calling. And so the other day, the new caller, Paul Ingus, was the regular caller at this Lakeland Squares dance, and his son now is the in-between tips mainstream caller.
I see.
And it's kind of interesting. And his son's 13, just turned 13.
Oh, yeah.
And he's a member of the association now.
That's great.
So we're getting the young people in.
Yes, well.
Just like Will Larson back in those days.
I was 13 when I started, too.
Ah, okay, there you go.
But we didn't have clubs in those days. This was 1933.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. mm-hmm. But, well.
Well, we had a dance for the new dancers. The Callers Association ran a dance for the new callers in the new dancers in New Jersey last week, and we had a section of the program. I should say first that one of the things we do at the Caller Association run dances is we try to have a lot of callers.
Yes.
Call the dances. So we had 9 callers calling at the beginning. And we had one portion of the dance set aside for callers who started calling in their teens.
Yes.
And so we had this new caller, Stephen Ingus, and myself, because I started at 19, and Betsy Gatta, who started at 14.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a wide range of people who started calling in their teens.
Right, right. Well, I think we're just about down to the first side of this tape. Why don't you take a second to breathe, and I'll take a minute, turn the tape over. Okay, hold on.
Sounds good.
Okay, we're back in business. And
okay.
So now we've got another 3/4 of an hour to talk. So,
yeah, I've got more notes than that.
Okay. Well, tell us all the notes that you have.
Well, I'm trying to think if I've said everything about the Callers Association.
Yes, right.
Actually, it's kind of neat having people like Betsy and John Kaltenfaller.
Sure it is.
There to have all that expertise in the club and
yes.
And to be able to, or in the Callers Association, and be able to ask them when you have questions about how to do things and so forth.
Right. Of course, you have the advantage of a lot more population within a short distance.
That's true.
Here in Albuquerque, for example, we've got, you know, almost half the population of New Mexico lives in Albuquerque. But outside of that, you know, you've got to drive 50 miles to get to the next big population. And so you have a concentration of potential customers, of course.
Yeah, well, right here in the New York area, we certainly do. But it's one of the things, for example, as president of the association, the Callers Association, we are very underrepresented in other parts of the state.
I see.
In Central Jersey, for example, there are very sparse, and the callers there are not part of our association. A couple of them are, but
yes.
There's other callers that aren't, for example.
Yes.
And down in South Jersey, it's even worse. There's one caller, Joe Landy, from way down south, and he's continued his membership, but there's some other callers around.
Yes.
And they aren't represented, so we're sort of concentrated up here in northern New Jersey.
Right.
And actually, we're sort of at the southern, in Bridgewater, the southern part. There's people down around Trenton. Mike Jacobs had a group down around Trenton, because he lived down that way. But other than that, it's hard, you know, people call me. Well, I should mention I run a couple of websites.
Yes.
And we can talk about that later. But one of them is for the Square Dance Council of New Jersey. So when people want to know where they're square dancing in New Jersey, I get emails.
Yes.
And a lot of times I can't tell them I can't help you. You know, we just don't have clubs and callers in those parts of New Jersey. And they say, oh, darn, you know, we'd like to start a club. We need to get going. And I just can't help them. So that's another one of my goals, is to maybe see if we can't get some interest in calling in some of the other parts of the states and get clubs going there. I have to tell them, you know, go over to Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
I hate to do that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, talking about your computer skills, I know when you first got a hold of me by email, I was amazed by some of the things that you told me, and in fact, you helped me out a great deal yourself with some of my little irritating problems with my computer, and I appreciate that. But where did you accumulate all these computer skills? You've got web pages coming out of your ears.
Well, that was my work and my hobby.
I see. It was your
for
work.
A long time. I, when I was in college, I, of course, took physics. I was going to become a physicist because of my mom's influence.
Yeah.
And it turns out that at Brown, Watson had been an alumni of Brown, and he gave Brown a computer. And I was taking applied mathematics at the time and having a heck of a time doing mathematics on a calculator.
Yes.
And I thought there had to be a better way. And they had this computer. So I took a computer course.
Okay.
And this was back in 60, 61. Well, I guess it was might have even been before that, 59. And anyway, I took the computer course, and when I got out of college, there was a large interest at that point in people who had computer skills. So I had offers from IBM and Western Electric at Bell Laboratories, and took a job with Western Electric at Bell Laboratories.
I see.
And which put me in a position, well, initially I was working on missile guidance systems, because those were years when missiles were important, and that was going to be the defense of the country, the missiles going up to shoot down the other missiles and so forth. So anything that could guide a missile was important to national defense.
Sure.
And so that's what I did right out of college. Was working for Western Electric on that. And a lot of people don't realize it, but at the time, Bell Laboratories was at the forefront of computer programming and computers. IBM had started making computers, but they were using Bell Laboratories operating systems. And nowadays we have Windows on our computers, but in those days, Bell Sys 1 and 2 were the operating systems that one would use on an IBM computer.
I see.
And so I took computing courses at Bell Laboratories taught by their people. So they were people who were very tied to computing at that point. And so I took with some of the people who were actually defining computing in those days. And that was really a heady time. And the other benefit was that computers had to be air-conditioned, because if you had a computer card with some code, and most people don't even know what a computer card is these days, but we used to type programs on computer cards and then run the computer cards into the computer to actually run a computer program.
Yes.
And the equipment was so finicky and the cards were processed so quickly that if the cards were in a non-air-conditioned room and then moved into an air-conditioned room, and the computer room had to be air-conditioned, that the cards would warp and you couldn't read the cards in. So all the programmers' offices had to be air-conditioned.
I'll be darned.
So we got the only air-conditioned offices. You know, the big bosses were in non-air-conditioned offices, and the computer programmers had air conditioning, which was interesting. But anyway, I was in on that, and after we got out of the missile guidance business, we worked on computer operating systems, and people who know about computer systems know that Unix was one of the early systems. And they were developing Unix at the Bell Laboratories Murray Hill location, and we were developing a competitor to Unix at Whippany. And so we were actually competing with the people who built Unix, and of course Unix won, and Unix became the operating system on all kinds of computers all over the world. But we were close. And then, after working on that, I worked on telephone computer software that all the telephone lines going between telephone offices had to be inventoried. And so we wrote software to convert paper records over to computerized records and then keep track of the computerized records. And I worked on that for many years. And that's what gave me my interest in,
well, in the
computer and where my skills came from there.
So I understand you're a webmaster with a few different groups. Is that right?
Yeah. I've got about 10 different websites.
Yeah, no, wow.
the story on that is interesting, too, because after I worked on the telephone inventory software, I went to the research laboratory. The name of the company by then had changed to Bellcore and then later to Telcordia. But they had a research arm, and I had always wanted to work in research. And so I was working in research for software testing, and I would periodically go down and talk to people at other Telcordia locations. And one day I went down, and this guy showed me something that was called Mosaic from University of Illinois and the National Center for Supercomputing Applications had paid for the development of this software, and Mark Andreessen had started and developed this. He was one of the two developers, and it just blew me away.
Yes.
I had never seen anything like that, and it turns out they were giving away the software free, and this was the first web browser, the first real web browser that eventually became Netscape, that eventually became Internet Explorer, that eventually became what we use today, the Mozilla and Firefox. It was the granddaddy of all that. And so the next day I went back to my computer and I put up a server and a web browser. And the darn thing worked right out of the box. And so for the next couple of months I went all around Telcordia telling everybody, you've got to see this new thing that's called the Internet and the web, and you can put up pages and you can see things and get all this information. And in those days, the researchers all had individual projects that they were working on, and so I thought, gee, I found this really neat project I can work on. And about 3 months later, I discovered that everyone else in the research area just about was working on this browser stuff, Mosaic. They were making search engines, and this was before Google was around. And
yes.
So I basically started with web-based stuff on the ground floor, and then I did research in that for probably 10 years and new means of communicating. So I've taken that now into the square dancing.
Yes, sir.
And I run four Square Dance websites. I run the Square Dance of New Jersey website. I run the Callers Council of New Jersey website. I run my own website, New Square Music. And I also run a website for Here to Dance, which is a system that I developed for people who are having trouble hearing the caller and have had to think about dropping out of dancing because they can't understand what the caller is saying. And that's another thing I could talk about, I suppose.
Well, yes, I think here at the Square Dance Hall in Albuquerque, don't we have a system whereby people can get a headset that they can put on that's connected to the computer and they hear directly? Is this...
Mm-hmm. There's some systems that have been around for ages for deaf people. And they make them... It's mainly for... They make them for students in classrooms. And so you have deaf students who go from classroom to classroom, and they each classroom broadcasts wirelessly on a different frequency. And so you need some fairly complicated gear. You need the transmitters transmitting on different frequencies, and the students have to be able to switch to the different frequencies as they move around from classroom to classroom.
Uh-huh.
And because of that, the equipment is expensive. And so when the people came to, we had some people in B-sharps who were having trouble, and so at one of the executive committee meetings, we brought this up, and we got a committee together to look into the situation, see what we could do. And we looked at these systems that were out there, and they were all very expensive, and they were so expensive that the individual people didn't really want to buy them to use them just for square dancing.
Yes.
And I know a number of clubs have the equipment, the transmitter, and then they loan out the receivers that the people wear. And
yeah.
Some people have bought their own, and some people have bought their own transmitters. But the thing was that now that they had iPods, if people wanted to have their music on something like that and then transmit it through their house, or maybe they're traveling in their car and they want to transmit it to their car radio, they have some electronics that you can connect that will transmit it on an FM frequency. And it turns out that the Sea Crane Company out in California had designed a transmitting unit which could transmit around a good-sized hall by that distance. So it wasn't just between the transmitter hung on a radio and the radio in your car. It was you could have a radio anywhere within a hall and still use this transmitter, and the transmitter was very inexpensive.
Yes.
And then the receiver, instead of being one of these special receivers that could only do the deaf frequencies, could just be any FM receiver. So a Walkman receiver could be used. And so what basically we put together a system which had one of these transmitters from Sea Crane, and now Bill Heyman has come up with a similar transmitter, except he sells it at a much higher price from his website.
Yeah, that's Bill.
Yeah, and so basically the Here to Dance system is something where the dancer buys a radio, a Walkman radio that can be used as a radio anytime you want it, but it can also be used for square dancing. The club buys a transmitter, which is also relatively inexpensive, and they only have that part. And you put the two of them together in a hall, and you have a system that can be used where the dancers can hear the caller because it's being transmitted directly through the radio, and then they can either use earphones, which a lot of the people do. They take out their hearing aids and they'll put in earphones.
Yes.
Or you can wear a neck. They have a yoke that goes around your neck that plugs into the radio, and then the yoke transmits to your earphone, your hearing aids.
Yes.
And so you can get it that way.
I'll be darned. That's it.
So you know, a number of people have continued dancing who wouldn't have it without that system, and the whole thing is really quite inexpensive.
Well, that's really, really interesting.
So it's a use of the technology.
Yes. Well, is this known about in around the square dance world?
A number of people do. It's certainly, there's a website for it. It's here-to-dance.com. HEAR-2-dance.com.
Uh-huh.
And the system is described there. We even have a streaming video of the system in use.
Oh, be darned.
We have Tom Miller is calling a square dance to a group of dancers, and then the audio is turned off, but the dancers are using the system. And it shows the dancers keep dancing, and you can't hear the audio, and then the music's turned back on, and the dancers are right at the right place in the music to the dance, and so on. And so it's an interesting thing to look at if you haven't looked at it.
Well, that's interesting. There for a while we were getting a little away from square dancing, and I'm glad you brought us back, because this is an interesting part of the, a new part of the activity for us old-timers.
Well, this is one of the things I wanted to talk about. You know, you always ask people about the future of square dancing.
Yes.
And a lot of people say, oh, it's not going to be like it was in the old days. People are dropping out and so on and so forth. But they're not talking, you know, they don't look at the advantages that the technology is providing for square dancing these days. And so I think that it's important for people to think about that and the positive things that are happening.
Right.
We basically, you know, I was listening to Jonesy Jones's interview,
yes,
you know, recently, and he's talking about when he got a NASCAL amplifier and a Yoke microphone, and he first started using that instead of a megaphone.
Yes.
And he's saying that people came up from the back and said, gee, I can hear you really well now, and you're doing some really great things. Well, that kind of thing was a paradigm shift in those days, which changed square dancing from where you had to, the dancers sort of memorized the calls.
Right.
And the music played, and the dancers did the dance, and the caller sort of prompted them once in a while, but most of the people knew it.
Yes.
And to where you could have patter calls where and hash where the caller could make up the call on the fly and the dancers would do it, and then you got into sight calling. And that was a whole, what I call a paradigm shift of where we were to where we went to in those days. Now we're at another paradigm shift, I think, where I can remember when at the Callers Association meeting, when Randy Page, he was a member of our Callers Association, he was president, and he came in and he held up his iPod and he said, look, I can hold all the music for a whole night of dancing on this little thing.
Yep.
And I just plug it into my amplifier. And, I mean, the advantage.